I'm a turtle, I'm a turtle, I'm a turtle.
Do not Amadeus this man.
Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
Welcome back, boys. How's it going?
Oh, it's been pretty good. Did you have anything interesting happen this week, Jared?
So I went and saw The Boy and the Heron yesterday.
Yeah. With Dove. English or?
English.
Okay.
Well, I guess. I don't know what accent Christian Bale was using. I think it's actually his normal speaking voice, but it's so weird.
Robert Pattinson impressed me in that movie.
I didn't believe it was him. I was like, who's voicing the Heron? And Dove looked it up and she's like, this can't be right. And I was like, wait, no, I saw an article about how he showed up to a recording session of something. I didn't pay attention to what, with 20 hours of stuff he'd recorded on his phone, just trying to get voices right.
Yep. I would not have known it was him if I hadn't been prior told. Like, the trailers had not come out yet with the English. We just went to see the English as soon as it dropped. We had already seen the Japanese, but was expecting sparkly, you know, vampire, like, these are the eyes of a killer, Bella. And instead I got, like, chain-smoking 60-year-old Gringotts goblin. And I was very impressed with that. You know, it was some good voice acting.
Did you like the movie?
I did. I felt like it was... How do I say this without pissing off the Ghibli fans? There is a line to which packing too much symbolism into a movie makes it a little dazzling. Maybe I'm just dumb, but, like, there was so much going on and every bit of it was some sort of metaphor.
Okay.
Also, One Piece was just going on in the background. Yeah, there was just boats the whole time.
There were. This feels very validating because Dove and I got out and we're both like, so it was beautiful. Obviously, that is bog standard for Studio Ghibli. But what was this story? Maybe I'm dumb. I mean, I had to watch Howl's Moving Castle twice to get it. She said she had to watch Spirited Away twice. This felt very derivative because I kept seeing moments. I'm like, this is Spirited Away. This is Howl's. This is Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, this was apparently Miyazaki, like... Supposedly, I have the understanding, or it's my headcanon that he continually says this is his last movie, just so the directive team will fuck off and leave him alone and let him do what he wants. But, you know, he's getting closer and closer to Visions. It's almost like Ridley Scott going back and doing Prometheus because he didn't have the technology to do Alien when it came out. Miyazaki has the capability of doing a lot more these days that he couldn't with the technology of the past, and I think we're seeing some ground being retread, but kind of dialed in and perfected. It felt, I got one for that. My wife almost killed me because I said that Miyazaki was the Japanese equivalent of C.S. Lewis. And she didn't like that at all. She's like, C.S. Lewis isn't that good of an actor. I was like, the Chronicles of Narnia are pretty robustly selling novel series and have been for a long time. And she's like, yeah, but The Boy and the Heron didn't have any of the religious undertones of the Chronicles of Narnia. I was like, you mean there wasn't one piece of cultural Japanese spiritualism present in that movie? Because I picked up on some. It's not the same thing. It kind of is. Like, C.S. Lewis has a Western cultural bias, which means Judeo-Christian undertones. Miyazaki has a Eastern bias, which means Japanese cultural spiritual undertones. Like, it's present.
I read an article that it's like, great-grandfather is stand-in for Miyazaki, and... The whole thing about I need someone to take over running this world is like him dealing with the fact that like his son wants to do other things and not make films like he does. And I guess reading that article, I was like, okay, retrospectively, I can kind of see that, but nope. It's not what I was picking up while watching the film.
It's going to be one of those films that takes you two or three watches through to like pick up all the stuff. One of the things that stood out to me most that I really enjoyed was certain characters that are old or older in the real world being their younger, vibrant editions. For me, it spoke to understanding and getting to know somebody for who they actually are rather than who they are in the frame of reference that is you. So... You know, old lady. she was a squared up badass in Fantasy World. Like seeing her in her prime just doing stuff, getting after it. I love that so much. And it reframed the older character when we got back to the real world. And I love that. Also, murder budgies.
I appreciated that this was like the most horror Ghibli film I've ever seen.
Mm.
Also, Willem Dafoe being a pelican.
Yeah.
So good.
God, we saw that in the Japanese, and I was not ready to hear Willem Dafoe do that. Like, I won't go into exactly why it was uncomfortable, but there are some things you don't want to listen to Willem Dafoe do.
Shall we move on at this point? Do you have a Will It Grong?
I do. Okay. So, again, trying to not get too specific with these, because we do have only a certain number, and we're going to stay at higher levels. So, I think my next Will It Grong is actually going to be a grizzly bear. Or just a bear in general. Could be polar bear, but we haven't seen a bear yet. I might have missed one that we discussed off-screen because I haven't heard the list of all the off-screens, but a bear feels like a pretty... It's a strong apex terrestrial predator. You know, there's a lot that you can do with, like, burly. There's a lot you can do with furs. You can do things with fangs, things like that. I could easily see somebody in, you know, a tank top with fur sleeves over it or fur coat over it, something like that, and just big, burly, muscly dude. So yeah, bear is going to be mine.
So at least here in the list of off-screened, because I have it written down, there is not a bear.
I love that you're basically doing a Pokedex of our Grongi, because you have all the names that we've been exposed to, but like a lot of those we haven't seen. So it's like in the Pokedex when you see a Pokemon, but you haven't caught it yet. So you have no information about it. It's just the outline and the name.
Yep. I just have the names for the Gos, except for Bada, Buro, and Bimiyu, since we know what theirs are. But like, no idea what Gadol's is, other than Ba, so some sort of insect, but yeah. Who knows?
There is no bear Grongi.
No bear.
Wow. Yeah, that seems like a miss.
Yeah, I felt like as we went through, because how many Grongi do we have total in the 40s, right? For the series?
Hold on. Let me check the Pokedex. 47 out of at least 210.
Yeah, I expected bear to be one. I feel like, you know, you get these monsters based off iconic animals, like, a grizzly bear is pretty iconic. That's a pretty scary predator. So, oh well, I guess I win this round.
Yeah.
We'll have to have you do one next time.
I have one in mind that I've been holding off of based off a conversation we had last recording session.
Okay. So what are we listening to today, Jared?
This week we are watching episodes 29 and 30, Crossroads and Fate.
I'm going to guess this is some sort of supernatural thing, like Crossroads Demons, Aleister Crowley, that whole thing, Crossroads Fate. Yeah, that feels very Crossroads-y. Somebody's going to sell their soul to be really good at guitar, and it's not going to be Godai, because I predict that's one of his 2,000 skills. If you hand that man a guitar, ukulele, or theremin, he's golden.
I can totally see him playing theremin.
Ooh. Fantastic.
Producer's note, there were some technical difficulties with my text-to-speech while recording, so most of my commentary is having to be added in post. We apologize for the choppiness. Episodes 29 and 30 were written by Arakawa Naruhisa and directed by Nagishi Takao. They originally aired August 20th and 27th, 2000.
Yeah! I got the money.
A jump to the sky turns to a writer review.
So this is a pretty solid start to this little story arc.
Yeah, no, I really like this method of attack for our villain. Like, this one feels very me. Like, if I was a Grongi, I could see doing something like this.
We'll get into it, but let's take it from the top, shall we? So we start off in the Adachi Ward inside of a small room, and there's a person there. We get a slow look at a switchblade on a sheet of newspaper, and it flicks open. We get a nice little close-up on the blade, light gleaming off of it, and a pan. And we see a potentially familiar, although if you don't remember, that's perfectly fine, spider tattoo on the neck.
Yes, it's everyone's favorite hoodlum, Junichi.
Yes.
He's here to be as edgy as possible, as long as possible.
This scene really makes it feel like nothing has changed since his last scene, but you know what?
People don't off-screen character growth in the series, Jared. People on-screen character growth in the series.
Kanzaki off-screen character growth, because he started caring again.
Okay, but he had a whole arc, though, right? He had a whole arc with Godai, where Godai taught him to care again and started him on that journey.
I guess that's fair.
Yeah. We just paused Junichi's development until we got back to him. He's into art now.
Yes. So I know I said that if Junichi ever showed back up, I would re-examine his character, but at the time, it really did nothing for me.
Yeah, you were trying to kick that can down the street, hoping it didn't come up again.
I'm going to be a man of my word and reassess the character by the end of this.
Okay. He does a bunch of art inside.
We don't even get the art. We just have him staring at the knife. We cut to opening credits. We cut to Polpol. And Godai is cooking again. We see the return of the frog mitt.
Yes.
Which,
it's honestly my favorite character.
And Pops is scrapbooking.
Showing a surprisingly amount of clarity for a man, you know, in his situation.
And he's discussing, you know, it was already exciting seeing ULF-4 go through all of his color changes, but now he's added on gold trim.
You know, it's interesting that we started discussing this episode, because we talk about Jean. This is the episode where we figured out that Jean actually knows who Kuga is, but Pops still doesn't. Pops is paying so much attention that he's narrowed down which forms haven't had extra conversions yet and says they're still to come. Like, he's meta-aware while staring at the character that works in his restaurant and hasn't made the connection.
I mean, Godai has given him the belt buckle, and still
he wears the logo.
Yes.
The bike he shows up to, quote-unquote, work in, has the logo on it. So he's either the biggest fanboy in the world, or that's Kuga.
This is Pops' quirk. He does mention that Red has not gotten the upgrade yet, but once it does, it'll be the full set. Thanks, Pops. I know what action figures I'm going to ask for Christmas.
I think Ichijo siphoned off Pops' powers of deduction. He has the observation, but Ichijo has the deductive capabilities.
Nana scolds Pops for scrapbooking instead of helping cook, and he proceeds to say, excuse me.
This does help the restaurant. Thank you very much.
There are patrons who come here to look at the scrapbook. Have you seen anyone look at the scrapbook other than him yet?
No, but now I want to go back and look at the episode with the G-Men and just hope one of them is just like, oh, this is really well put together.
That would be great. Pops then starts to ramble a bit about how he hopes a fully gold form shows up eventually, because then he will make a special curry with gold leaf in it.
Ah, truly the gold schlager.
Of curries. From there, we cut to Jonin, and Sakurako's not at her computer. She's pacing back and forth. It is worth noting that the decorations on the computer have changed. We don't
get a small bird statue.
Yeah, it looks like a cardinal, but we don't get a good look at it.
Yeah, there's probably something else there, and I'm sure it's super important to the plot that we take time to point this out, but we'll continue to do so.
But she's pacing back and forth, going back over the prophecy about when the holy spring dries up and
darkness,
the warrior descends by thunder. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's worried about this. And there's a flash on her computer saying
translation complete.
She seems hesitant to look at this, but she doesn't have to, because who walks in at this moment? Jean.
Mm-hmm.
And Mika.
You remember Mika?
Sure. Yeah. This is the first morose child to walk around.
Listen, we have 100% survival rate on wandering or morose children, and I'm okay with that.
My God, you're right, we do. So, Jean proceeds to say that he's brought Mika here to look at the Go-Ram. I guess show her, hey, here's the particular piece that you gave.
Yes, that's your bit, right there, buddy. Look at that.
And Mika looks at Sakurako and is like, I'm glad I could help out Goad. I mean ULF-4. And Jean's like, you could just say Godai. I know.
Damn.
And we finally got clarification, because we've been here assuming that everyone just assumes he knows and hasn't said anything.
You know, this episode in a weird way cleared up a lot of like dangling questions we had. Like, you know, exactly who knows who Godai is, really. Also brings up a lot of our past characters.
Yeah.
That I thought were bit players, but now they're back.
So it turns out Jean didn't know for a while, and then at some point Inakita just told him.
Probably in exchange for more papercraft books.
Possibly. It is also brought up that Jean has stopped going by the Institute as often. Because remember, in the last set, it was mentioned that he was there every day.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like there's been a bit of a time skip, and he's not going anymore.
Yeah.
We cut to the Research Institute, and Inakita is there talking with, I guess it's the chief, about how the Gorongi are adding more and more complex rules to their games. And he's like, yeah, but they're also getting more and more powerful. And there's some banter back and forth. They come to a storage locker. There's an elephant door that raises up, and we see the silhouette of a bike. And Inakita says that she has analyzed the Tri-Chaser after merging and unmerging with the Go-Ram, and that this new thing, I'm guessing this is what they were talking about in the last set of episodes,
yeah,
that it is rated to be able to handle 200 mergings with the Go-Ram. How does she know this?
This is her arbitrary superpower. They're incredibly niche, but incredibly effective.
Yes.
Before we move on, they also did talk about, in addition to the bike, Inokita specifically mentioned that they're developing several, multiple new weapons that they believe, yes, will be useful against the Grongi. So, brand new war crimes bullets? Potentially more war crimes technology?
War crimes on war crimes on war crimes.
My fervent hope. Like, we've talked a lot about doing predictions for this series. I know it's a pipe dream, but I want Godai to have, like, a tank that fuses with the Go-Ram, and for him to, like, go toe-to-toe with a big Grongi with, like, a Go-Ram tank. Not a Go-Ram tank, a Go-Ram tank.
Yes, I understood the difference.
Stop shaking your head. Why you gotta crush that dream? Out of all the dreams, you had to just... Fine, that's fine. I can't have nice things.
My prediction is still we get up to a war crime where eventually Ichijo is able to actually kill one.
Do you think by the end of the series there will be a non-Godai Grongi kill?
I mean, technically there has been one, but that was because they
not self-inflicted. Not Godai and not incompetence.
Surely they've got to. They've got to let him do something at some point.
So yours is hopeful optimism.
Yeah.
Okay.
Surely Ichijo will get one.
I'm excited to see what she's talking about, though. Because every time their technology, every time the police technology almost catches up, they start being effective, we have a Grongi jump in strength and they're no longer effective.
We cut to an elevator, and Labarubade, Gogadol Ba, and Zugo Magoo are riding up, and Gadol is expressing concern insofar as the semifinals are on hold as long as Kuga is around.
Yeah, it seems like they're now actually worried that no one will be able to complete a game until they deal with Kuga.
Their concern is not Kuga still offing them. It is, we cannot progress in the game until something is done about him because he keeps killing us. And Gadol says that he'll kill Kuga himself if it means getting the game back on track.
They really view Kuga as like the Three Musketeers bar in the pool. Like, everybody has to get out. We can't participate until we deal with this. Then it's back to business as usual. Yeah, that was a Caddyshack reference.
Wasn't that a Baby Ruth?
Oh, because
it had peanuts
Ruth
in it.
Yep, it was a Baby Ruth bar. Good catch.
Goma is still suffering from eczema, it seems, because he's scratching himself again.
Mm-hmm. He's not looking very healthy these days. I mean, for a vampire man, he never really did, but...
No. The elevator gets to the top, and they come into a penthouse-looking thing, and they make a point to linger on a roulette wheel for a while.
Probably won't come up.
No. We see a couple of the other Gorongi sitting around, Zalazu and Jalaji, who we don't know anything about other than their names, and that's solely thanks to producer Jed giving me those notes when they all showed up back, mm-hmm, in Burroughs episodes.
Yep, Zazzle and Gelato over here.
And Baruba turns to the mafioso one, Gogamego Rei.
Gogamego Rei was portrayed by Kazuyoshi Sakai, who would go on to play Ushigome Sotaru, Gao Black, in Gao Ranger. Gamego is derived from Kame, meaning turtle.
So yeah, he is a turtle yakuza.
Okay, but this is sort of interesting, though, because do you know what turtles are associated with in Japan?
No, tell me.
Good fortune, as in good luck.
So, gambling.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that makes sense for his methodology. It still doesn't make sense so much about his human form, and this is something I have noticed and I'd like to bring up. And I don't know if this is just observation on my part, if it really does play into something. So when we first showed up, the zoo looked like, you know, Village People rejects.
They did look like the
They're
Village People.
They're all in, like, bondage gear, or things that stood out but didn't really do much.
They're feral theater kids, really.
Then we got the Mei, and their human forms were even more bizarrely costumed, but they tied in so much to their monster form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got sad crying clown with the fringe vest because he's a squid.
Oh, I'd forgotten about his human form.
The saddest clown.
Oh my god, yep, goofball.
We get the other clown who is a hermit crab and thus just sticks stuff to himself randomly. But now we've got the Go, and their costumes are the most human. Like, walking through a crowd, they would not stand out.
But out of
except date. Maybe Gadol, since he's got epaulets.
All of them are wearing the affectations of previous eras. Nobody's really wearing straight-up modern attire. Like, I was thinking to myself that most of these characters feel now like somebody that would be invited to a Gatsby party, like in the 20s, you know. We got pinstripe suits, we've got lace, we've got old-style motorcycle jackets, all sorts of particular affectations that are hallmarks of other eras.
Interesting. What era was Burroughs purple leather from?
The 80s.
Touché. I'll accept that.
Yeah, 70s or 80s. Like, James Dean is definitely, like, post-World War II recovering soldier aesthetic. You know, like, he's just out there, Kerouac-style, rambling about the countryside, learning some shit.
I mean, he's just pretty similarly, not exactly, but pretty close to Hongo the first time we see him.
Mm-hmm,
he's, everything about him, other than just exuding pure cool, is also an original Kamen Rider tribute.
Producer's note. I'm pretty sure Jared is crushing on Bada harder than I am.
I think you're onto something. The dress affectations of these different groups do have a lot of coordination between them.
It's just interesting seeing how it is changed from group to group.
Mm-hmm.
But to get back on the story, Baruba turns to Gamego and tells him 567 people in 72 hours.
Holy shit.
That is a lot in a short amount of time.
Yep, you gotta kill damn near 600 people in 3 days. Go.
And he says, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we cut to the hospital, and Tsubaki, Ichijo, and Godai are all there, and they're looking at new CT scans of Godai. And remember the first time that Tsubaki did a CT scan of him, and first off, we were shocked that the belt didn't destroy everything, but he brought up the increased muscle density and nerve endings throughout his body, and that if that progressed far enough, he would be a biological weapon similar to the Kurongi. Well, we get a rehash of that.
Yeah, it feels very deja vu to that conversation.
This is progressed farther. There's more going on here now.
That's something I have noticed in the show as well, is that we do tend to revisit the same conversations and each time just move them forward a little bit. Like, it seems like every couple of episodes we get somebody who the entire sideline of the episode is somebody being really worried that Godai has lost his way. And at the end of it, we get a big thumbs up and they're like, no, that's just Godai. This feels very samey to that. Like, we're revisiting, hey, if this keeps progressing, I don't know what's going to happen to you. We seem to have some of those that come up fairly frequently.
Maybe because it is important.
Yes. And a discussion starts about the arrival of the rising forms, or specifically the tingles, as he put it.
The Peter tingles.
And Godai brings up that after his brush with death, that he wished to become stronger, and that's when the tingles started. And Tsubaki brings up, like, well, there's a lot more connections from your central nervous system to the belt now. Maybe the Amadam chose to interpret those requests and give you additional power. But, yeah, you're even closer to being just a biological weapon than you were before. Also, how's your right leg? Because you should be in a considerable amount of pain.
Yeah, his scan of the right leg is just webbed with what I assume are supposed to be extra...
nerve, you know, clusters? Yeah. I don't... Yeah, somewhat unclear.
I'll ask the wife.
But Godai is like, nope, I'm fine. It's me. And gives the thumbs up and... Well, that seems to end the conversation. He goes to leave. There's a brief moment with Ichijo and Tsubaki hanging back going, should we tell Sawatari? And Godai goes out to his motorcycle, sits down for a moment, gets a 1,000-yard stare.
Yeah, he is about to put on his helmet and then just kind of lets it fall to his lap. This is kind of one of the first indications we've had that Godai's outward optimism may not reach all the way to his core. Like, this is a brave face he's putting on for everybody else to a certain degree. Like, that was my interpretation of this scene, is Godai being like, guys, I'm fine. I can do this. Don't worry about it. And then the minute he's alone, he's just like, oh.
Oh, this is worse than I thought.
This damage is permanent. No. I wonder if it's self-doubt or just, yeah, I don't know.
It's hard to say. I'm sure we'll get... Well,
yeah. This show is pretty good about, you know...
Shockingly good at clarifying things.
It doesn't leave dangling threads.
We cut to the Sumita Ward, and Doldo is standing there.
Oh, it's Doldo. Good boy, Doldo.
And we see just a random woman standing there, and we hear a noise, and she looks up, and there's something in the air.
The world's most aggressive keychain.
And she screams... and runs and ducks behind some bushes, and she looks back, and another woman who happens to be walking by turns and looks and sees it, and the camera cuts back to the one hiding behind the bushes, and we hear a crunch.
Uh-huh, and her reaction shot, which is screaming.
I want to note that once we hear the crunch, we hear absolutely nothing until the woman screams. It's a couple seconds of just pure silence.
Yeah.
Camera lingers on her for a bit. Cuts back to Doldo. He walks out, is looking around, and there are bodies and crashed cars and giant, well, not giant, we see a very tiny, like, ball and chain.
Mm-hmm.
And Doldo says of 54 shots taken, 37 deaths. And he moves some beads on the abacus. We cut back to the Adachi Ward, and Junichi is furiously working on a piece of art. And he's got a newspaper that he's looking at as well, and there's a thing down at the bottom, and they don't translate it, and I don't speak or read Japanese, so I'm not sure if this is an art exhibition or an art contest, but it's clearly something to do with art, and there is a date on it. Potentially, like, submissions must be in by, taking a guess based on context. Mm-hmm. And then he takes some spray sealant and, without wearing a mask or making sure the room is properly ventilated, just starts spraying the piece down.
In his studio apartment. Maybe this is why he was tweaking the fuck out last time and, like, had visions of himself as a grongy. Like, breathing enough aerosol sprays in your own house will cause you to hallucinate. His story could be entirely explainable by an obsession with art and poor ventilation. It's not what that is, but I think it's hilarious that that's my new headcanon.
From there, we cut to a waiting room in the hospital, and Tsubaki and Ichijo are there talking. It's a pretty cool framed shot.
It's a long shot that's backlit. It captures the mood perfectly. They feel so small and lost.
It's a very well-framed shot. Ichijo is, of course, worried about his boyfriend. And Tsubaki's like, I'm gonna choose to believe him. Like, come on, that thumbs up, it's so sincere. How can you not?
Yeah, he would never prevaricate and throw a thumbs up when he didn't feel it. Right?
Yeah. They discuss a bit more of the ethics, one of relying on Godai, which, hey, I'd love to know the alternative.
Yeah, they always talk about this, like, should we ask him to stop? And it's, nothing you've done has proved effective. What is your plan if Godai steps out?
Let the Gurungi win?
Yeah, I guess. It's monster
time. I mean, we'll find out there's a bit more going on, but at this point in time, we don't know that.
Ah, fresh war crimes.
Multiple.
Producer's note. I feel it's important to note that one of the big themes of Kuga is the toll violence takes on those who do it, even if for a good reason. They know there isn't an alternative, but that doesn't mean they have to be happy about what is happening to Godai.
We cut to Godai, riding his bike down the street. Ichijo calls, and Godai's like, oh, is it about the ULF attack? Yeah, I heard it on the radio. I'm already heading that way. Because remember, all comms are open comms.
Mm-hmm.
We cut back to this penthouse the Gurungi are in, and we see that I think it's Jumanji,
yes,
has a map book.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be map of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And then the roulette wheel spins, and they follow the ball, and it lands on Red 16. And he flips some pages in the book and says that Red 16 is this particular area. So, as we understand Gamigo's game, Tokyo has been divided up based around this one particular building.
Roulette wheel, yeah.
Has been divided up into quadrants that line up with a roulette wheel. And so they will spin the wheel, see where the ball lands, and that's the next area he's going to attack.
And, oh, God, and I love his method of attack.
It seems that he does 54 attacks in each square.
Mm-hmm.
54 seemed important, but the best I could come up with is a deck of cards with two jokers.
Potentially?
Or is a roulette wheel divided into 54 parts?
I don't think so.
I don't actually know how many different options there are for a roulette wheel.
0 to 36.
So no. Okay.
Number ranges from 1 to 10 and 19 to 28. Odd numbers are red and even are black. And then they flip in the other one. They've got the 0. Yeah, no, nothing there.
So maybe it could be related to cards. Who can say?
Mm-hmm.
The show, probably.
Yeah, they don't leave a whole lot of dangling threads. We discussed this.
So they have selected the next area that they're going to attack. And so we sure enough cut to that area, and Doldo is there, and James Dean pulls up on his bike.
Is he going to the areas and attacking from there, or is he launching his attacks from the penthouse?
He seems to be launching the attacks from the penthouse.
Yeah.
Bada asks Doldo if the game has begun yet, and Doldo's response, talking. Well, I guess he already talked because he announced the kill count, but man, he's talked more in this episode than he has in the last several. He says, oh, the attack's beginning now. And we get a rain of ball and chain, and the first one smashes into a car windshield, and it veers and slams into another car, which another car then hits the back of it. And I have to wonder, does that count as one kill, or does each person, if they in fact died from this car crash?
I would suspect that anyone who dies as a direct result of his attack counts as a kill, especially with his kill count so being so arbitrarily large. In such a short amount of time, I have to assume that he's getting credit for all of those kills.
I don't know, Doldo specifically says hits, so I think anything besides a direct hit is just collateral damage.
And we get some chaos. Then we get to cut to Doldo saying that, again, out of 54 attacks, 51 hits.
Yep. But did we discuss exactly how he does it yet? Because we discussed the impact.
We did see at the start, as he walks out to the top of the penthouse and points in the direction that he's about to throw, he takes we see the little, the tiny ball and chain that we saw before. Mm-hmm. He has a bunch of them on his hand, and he takes one off, and because the Go can do this, it transmogrifies into a large one, and he spins it and throws it, and then grabs another, repeats.
Yep, it's freaking awesome. This man has divided Tokyo up into grid coordinates, assigned those grid coordinates to a roulette wheel, and is doing basically artillery strikes.
Yes.
54 morning stars at a time.
And you may be saying to yourself, that's insanity, and you're right. However, this one's a bit more straightforward than last week's.
It's not that convoluted, but it is incredibly effective.
The other thing you might be asking is, what do morning stars and turtles have in common?
And if you can find out, you did better than we did.
The closest thing we can come up with is the fact that Bowser uses a chain chomp sometimes. Other than that, I got nothing.
Yeah, like chain chomps, the ball and chain being associated with Bowser from Mario. Maybe there's a cultural context that we're not getting to. But, I mean, not to doofenshmirtz it too much, but, like, I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
Yeah. We cut to a bus, and we see Junichi's there. He's got his art portfolio, and he's got the newspaper clipping, and we get another close-up on it. But again, they don't translate it. But this time we do get a clearer shot of, like, a date and time, so it's got to be a submissions are due by this. And he's checking his watch, comparing. And the bus pulls to a stop, and Junichi's getting real nervous.
Artbox public submissions information. Now accepting submissions for a green tea commercial. Really?
Oh, okay.
You know what? I'm going to say it. Kudos to him for trying to put the weirdness of his past behind him and focus on new hobbies.
Indeed. But he's still sitting there. We cut to Jonin, and Sakurako is there. She opens a book and finds a note in there that says, you know, we need an urgent translation. A lot of text is there. They do translate it. We did not freeze frame to read the whole thing.
The note is from Godai back when they were in Nagano.
As she is looking at this, she gets a phone call, and it's Tsubaki, and we don't hear the conversation, but it's clear that it is him telling her about the conversation that he'd already had with Ichijo and Godai. And she just thanks him for it, hangs up. We cut to the Sumita Ward. Ichijo and Godai are both driving. They come from different areas, but they end up beside each other. And it's that point Nozomi comes over the radio and says that they've figured out that the attacks have all been in a straight line from one particular building. And Ichijo asks Godai to head there immediately. Police siren flips on. They take off.
Which, have there been more attacks other than just the
yes,
two so far?
Yes, they say there have been, I think they say nine.
So how many freaking
people
are dead?
We don't have an updated kill count. Yes, last we had was 88, but this is more.
That's
somewhere between 88 and 486, depending on accuracy.
Yeah, 88 off 2 is already freaking impressive. I thought the 567 number was high, but if he can knock out 51 at a time, potentially, that's not a hard number to hit. It all comes down to how often he can do this.
As long as he's making good numbers, because he has yet to get like a 54 out of 54.
True. We also haven't seen a zero.
But I do wonder if it gets to the last district on the roulette wheel, is he allowed to do again? Also, if, because, you know, the roulette wheel is random, if it lands on a district he's already done, is he able to go back or does he have to spin the wheel again?
Nah, hit him again. If it lands on zero, does he have to throw it straight up and then like dodge?
Bonk. Who knows? So at the Research Institute, Inakita's there. She's talking with the other scientists. And right as she walks off screen, Jean and Mika come in. And Jean sees Inakita as she's walking away and gets a really sour look on his face. Clearly there's something has happened between the two of them, which would explain why he's not going to the Institute as often anymore.
Listen, Jared, people don't like receiving unsolicited parenting advice. It tends to rub the wrong way.
I can speak from experience. Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We cut to Samita Ward, Godai, Nichijou pull up to the building that, from the look of it, hey, this is where the Gurungi are. They also state this is the headquarters for some corporation. Which, why a corporation has a penthouse casino in there?
Have you met rich people?
No, I haven't.
No.
Have
they're
you?
Like that.
Oh. Detached from reality, motherfuckers.
My mom had one dude that used to run one of her companies that was upset that he had to move his basketball course to put in his observatory because they needed the same piece of real estate on his property.
I hate everything about that sentence you just said.
So that's why the Gurungi have access to a roulette wheel. But, lo and behold, there, on the rooftop, click, 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 is a turtle.
Yes. Godai looks up. We really quick cut back to the bus. It's there in traffic. Junichi has gone up to the bus driver. He's like, hey, do you know when we're going to get moving again? When are we going to get to this stop? And the bus driver's like, hey, traffic's normally not this bad.
My bad, bro.
We'll get there when we get there. And right then, a police officer comes by on his motorcycle with a bullhorn announcing that all traffic has been stopped because of Gurungi attack and that they're going to be rerouting. And Junichi has none of this and demands that the bus driver open the door. Cutting back to Godai, he jumps. He's in dragon form, so he just clears the top of the building. He does a flip and turns into mighty form. And oh man, I love mid-action transformations like that.
Yeah,
this is great.
Godai's developing his skills. It's no longer just switch into form, do it till it doesn't work. He used one form for traversal and then flip for combat. That's awesome.
And we get a brief little bit of hand-to-hand combat where he then knocks Gamego Ray off the building.
Ah, God, and just the most delightful campy CGI when he lands, too. Every part of that felt so real. It did not.
We get a beautiful shot of the other go inside the penthouse.
Watching him fall. Yeah.
Guys, should we do something about that? No, it's his game, bro.
Godai turns back into dragon form to safely leap down. Gamego Ray pulls himself up out of a pile of rubble.
Because they couldn't do a crater in the middle of the city street. So we've talked about practical effects, and I love the practical effects they do in this episode, but it's so funny. It reminded me, and I hate that I'm bringing it up again, in Masked Rider, when they had the crater the kid landed in the backyard that was an above-ground crater because they couldn't dig a hole. It was that. They just built a little half-moon of cobblestones for him to rise out of. Spectacular.
Look, man, you got budget, you got all sorts of things you have to...
Municipal code issues.
This clearly was filmed on location and not in a soundstage, so...
You know, fair enough.
We
you
can't
work with
tear
what you
up
got.
The ground. He rises up. There's a bit of a fight with Godai still in dragon form, but there's no sticks around or anything that he can try and turn into dragon rod. So he dodges an attack, pulls the command lever off of the Tri-Chaser... Titan form. We've shifted through three forms in this fight scene. This is great.
Dude, I'm hoping that he finishes the fight in Titan. I'm sure he won't. I'm sure we'll see more, but like heavy brawler turtle versus Titan form, like hell yeah, let's go.
It's also really cool. This we get some great shots looking more at Gamego and seeing that like the armor plates of the turtle are chained to him.
Yep. Yep. Just don't look at his feet.
I thankfully haven't seen them.
Mm-hmm. Them toes are real. His, for the audience members who haven't watched the episode yet, his feet look like, if you were to buy like a rubber foot at like a Halloween store, they look kind of like that with just like painted on toenails. Oh, it's spectacular. You'll see.
Look, you gotta cut somewhere for budget.
Speaking of cuts, we cut straight back to Junichi,
who is running up to a police barricade, and the police are like, hey, you can't go this way. ULF attack.
And he goes, look, a monkey, and then leaps over their barricade and tries to run past them.
He says, I don't give a damn. Jumps over the barricade, tries to run past them. He ends up getting tackled by like five of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the last shot of the episode is him screaming, let go of me.
Yeah.
I'm this running out of time.
This is a really important art contest where we have no context for what he's actually doing.
And that's the episode.
I'm really excited. This is one of my favorite Grongi so far. Like, I'm not going to lie already. I'm hoping it resolves well, because we've got a whole nother episode for us to have some misses, but I like this design so far. You want to get after it?
Yeah, let's go ahead and get to the next one.
No fear, no pain.
Is that our new cutback? You know what? I love it. I respect that a lot.
Same. I didn't know we were going to end this story arc with the retelling of the beginning of Akira, but okay.
Okay, but I do love these episodes. Let's get after it.
All right, so we start off again. The repeat of the end of the last episode, Godai's in dragon form, grabs the control stick from the bike, Titan form. And he just starts walking. And Gamego throws, and the first one just sort of hits his chest, bounces off, does nothing. Second one hits him again. He kind of pauses for a moment. Third one hits him in the stomach. He bends over. Fourth one hits him in the head. He's knocked down.
Mm-hmm. Things aren't looking well for our hero.
No. Opening credits. We then cut to the bridge, and we see that Junichi
the world's
is
most tolerant cops or the world's strongest single man?
Could be either one. Probably tolerant cops, because one of them eventually just steps around in front of him and is like, hey, buddy, for your own safety, turn around.
Which is fine. I'll go start my own art project, Blackjack, and he goes and hops over the barricade the other way and runs off.
We cut back to Godai and Gomego, and Godai stands up, grabs the baton back because the sword turned back into the baton. We see the spark of electricity. The belt goes gold. And he turns into Rising Titan. God, still, it looks so good.
It would look better if he did anything to dodge the wrecking balls that the dude is throwing at him the whole time.
But this time, the wrecking ball hits him and does nothing.
It's the exact same hubris that we'll see later in the episode not work out.
Yes.
But he just walks through a constant barrage of balls to the face.
And goes to do Rising Calamity Titan. And we see the sword actually sinks in.
Yep. Gets through all the balls, achieves penetration.
The symbol appears. The symbol appears. And Gamega goes, nope.
Alt F-U.
Pulls the sword out, and we see that a good, I don't know about yay much.
Bombastic. Probably.
Yes, I know it makes for terrible radio that I'm holding my hands up to try and measure.
It wasn't just the tip, we'll put it that way.
And Godai gets knocked back, turns into regular Titan, and then into growing.
I mean, before he does that, fucking Gamera grabs him and just whoops the monkey shit out of him and throws him across the room. Well, porch.
Fair.
Deck. Exterior industrial area.
Street.
Yeah, he knocks him all the way back to base Beetleborg. It's rough.
And once again, just like with Burrow punched through him with owl pellets, the fact that we know that he's gone into growing form means there's going to be a time limit before he can use any sort of abilities again. And let's go ahead and use that as an excuse to bring up this week's Tropusatsu. Hour of Power. So, superpowers come largely in two types. Those that are always on, Superman most of the time. And then there's those that have to be activated. Hour of Power is a special limitation that is put on that latter category. So, power that's under the influence of Hour of Power will only last so long.
So this trope is specifically referring to powers that have a constraint of time on them.
Yes. Time frame's usually an easy number to remember, minutes, an hour. The trope is named for something else we'll get to in a minute, but an easy way to think of it is the DC superhero Hourman, who gets his powers from a special pill that when he takes it, he gets them for exactly 1 hour, hence his name.
I didn't even know that was a character.
He's an old Golden Age hero that they don't do a lot with these days, but yes. It's mostly used as a trope to build tension if and when the writers actually stick to it, and particularly here in Kuga, they do a good job of it. We've seen a consistent about 2 hours is the time frame if he goes back into growing form before he can do anything again. It's named after a spell from the RPG Might and Magic, which was just called Hour of Power.
Huh. Okay, so that's cool.
Thinking about the time frame, there is a good chance that the makers of that game borrowed it from Hourman.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure the character came out in the 30s. We first saw this originally with the first time he went into Pegasus form. 50 seconds in form, 2 hour cooldown. And here's where we see it being applied to the rising forms. We saw it with Burrow, but because that was rising Pegasus, you know, we weren't entirely sure if that was rising or because of Pegasus that we had to have the cooldown.
Right.
Here's making it established it is rising form that's got the hour of power limitation on it.
Yeah. One of the things I do really like about this trope in particular is it gives us the ability to see some really cool stuff that cannot, because of its power level, be allowed to be the standard. I'm a big anime fan, so like All Might from My Hero Academia, having that limitation forces them to work around it and allow other characters to shine.
This also gives us the time limit for our rising forms. 30 seconds.
That's it. That's all he can maintain it for.
30 seconds in rising, and then 2 hour cooldown.
Damn.
The show doesn't say it here, but we'll establish it later. I did, however, count, and it was indeed 30 seconds.
So we'll cross that when we get to it.
We'll burn that bridge when we get to it.
As the saying goes. Kamego, for whatever reason, choosing not to just go ahead and kill Godai.
Yeah, in what is one of my least favorite tropes in all of movies and cinema, Gamera just doesn't finish the damn job. Godai is on the ground in base form, and he's just like, huh, sucks to be you, and fucking walks away.
He says specifically, try a different color.
Yeah, like, what the shit?
All Grongi are cosmically arrogant, but, oh, man, he did, in fact, impale you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He almost got you. Symbol appeared. You managed to shrug it off, but why not? He's in the way of the game. Just kill him. So the movie can happen.
Yeah. We get a quick cut to Junichi, who's crawling through a small underpass. Crawling's not the right word. He's crouched down. It's not quite tall enough for him to walk. Running,
you know?
And he rounds a corner, and we hear a thud. And we see the portfolio get knocked back and hit the ground. The camera then moves forward and around, and we see that Junichi had walked smack into Kamego, who is back in his human form. And he just sort of looks down at Junichi and says, bad luck for you.
Yeah, Junichi got put into the hospital from running into Gamera.
Yes. At the hospital, Tsubaki gets a call from Ichijo, who informs him that Godai is on his way, that he fought, couldn't beat him, has gone back into growing form. Please take a look at him, make sure everything is okay. They're about to go investigate the building. And as he hangs up the phone, Sakurako comes in. We cut to the Grongi hideout, and we see that the cops are examining everything, including the roulette wheel. And they're like, none of this makes any sense whatsoever.
To which we can mostly agree.
Yes. They measure up, okay, yes, this building had good line of sight over most of the city. Oh, God. We're going to have to try and manually check for other buildings to see if this is going to keep happening. Ichijo takes his time to call Inakita and ask how the new project's coming. And she's like, hey, we don't have the full new war crime bullets yet.
Oh, they have the bullets, but now they have to upgrade the weapons so they can handle the bullets.
Yes, and Ichijo's like, well, do you have a prototype I could use? And she's like, yes, but the recoil's gonna be a bitch and a half.
Just cuts her off like, I don't care, come send me that shit. I love Warpath Ichijo. Like, somebody hurt his boyfriend, and now somebody's going to pay.
Yes, nothing. Nothing at all will stop him from avenging boyfriend being hurt.
These new rounds will break your collarbone. Yeah, but it'll break theirs too. Come here.
Mine will heal. Theirs won't. As his phone call ends, Sean comes in with Mika. And there's that tension again.
Oh, they fucking!
Yeah, it certainly feels that way.
It's gotta be, even from what the little girl says, because the little girl specifically mentions that, like, when Jean writes to her, he describes her as young and beautiful.
And he's giving her a look like, shut up!
Mika, shut the fuck up! Meanwhile, Inakita's like, why is she here?
Yeah, this is odd development. We'll see how that story plays out, I guess.
Hopefully.
We cut to a red-lit room, and we see that Gamego...
Yeah, Spider-Base, yes.
Zelazu and Jalachi are... I know it's a table, but I'd like to believe that they're in fact sitting around just a wine barrel.
Sure.
And they're... Poker, I think that's what they're playing. They're playing a card game.
Yeah, with these circular coaster-looking playing cards.
They have to be unique.
Bro.
We do also see for a moment he holds his stomach. He is still wounded.
Got a tummy.
And Baruba comes in, asks if he's going to be able to continue playing the game or not. He says yes, and he brings up a Linto phrase that he thinks is very appropriate to this situation. Que sera, sera. Which... if you don't speak French, is what will be, will be.
Thought it was cheese, Sarah, Sarah.
Only if she consents. And Baruba asking for no explanation because, again, they're speaking in Grongi, but now using French when every other time they're speaking in quote-unquote Linto, it's Japanese. Maybe they're all polyglots? Who can say?
Or maybe Grongi is just French.
I'd understand. There's no way to know, Jared. I feel like
there's no way to know, Jared.
Well, okay then. Baruba responds with, well, good. Seems like fortune smiling on you. Which I guess ties back to the whole turtles and luck thing.
Also, a little piece that I was able to pull up. Another one of the things that turtles are associated with is support. And this has led to some connotations militarily in terms of supporting fire. So turtles in Japanese media are sometimes associated with artillery. We've seen this a couple of times in Yu-Gi-Oh! Has some artillery tortoise that's a fairly iconic card. Zoids, we have the cannon tortoise. So he is both luck in the gambling and support in terms of his ability is basically an artillery shelling of a grid coordinate.
So that's why he's throwing morning stars, is because turtles are artillery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Artillery, if you will. Or if you won't, I don't really care.
We cut to the hospital. Sakurako and Tsubaki are talking. And there's some discussion about, you know, the changes that have been happening to Godai and how quickly he can heal from things, but what sort of toll that must take on his body. I'm guessing they're thinking more like his metabolism. Tsubaki specifically states that the injuries Godai has sustained would take a normal person like 5 months to heal, but that he thinks Godai is going to be fine in about 3 hours. So remember, 2 hours power limit, 3 hours healing for this particular instance.
Yeah.
They come into the room to find that the bed's empty and the dressing gown has been laid down rather nicely. Godai took time to fold it and put it back on the bed.
Skill number 64. Folding.
Godai jumps out from behind a curtain and is like, surprise, I didn't leave. And they're like, you're okay? And he's like, yeah, I feel fine.
For real?
His healing seems to have increased to an even greater rate than they realized.
What? Crazy.
And as they're talking, some nurses bring in another patient, and it's Junichi. Tsubaki and Godai immediately recognize him. Godai takes a look at the drawing. He goes, wow, that's really soothing. I love this.
Aw.
Godai decides, hey, I'm going to take care of some things. Tell Junichi I say hi when he wakes up. We cut to Popol. Pops and Nana are there. When Jean and Mika walk in, and Pops calls him John Mitchell. And he's like, no, Jean-Michel.
Sorel.
Jean and Nana have the moment where they're finally like, you're that person I bumped into at the train station. And Mika asks about Godai. And this sets Nana off. It's just not that into
you. Yeah, she asks a literal child if she's also...
Are you in love with him too? And she's like, what are you talking about?
You crazy, crazy human.
She calms down immediately. Neither Jean nor Pops choose to comment on this, probably for the best. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, the scene then cuts away. Back to the hospital. And Junichi is awake, and he goes to a payphone. And he calls the ad agency. And he's like, hey, I know that it's past the deadline, but things happen, and they literally hang up on him.
Which is rude as shit.
Yes. And Tsubaki sees the exchange, offers his condolences, but tells him, hey, there'll be others.
God. Yeah, Junichi, we said we'd reevaluate him when we got back to him, but man, he's got a poopy face most of this episode.
We'll talk about him more.
Yeah.
We cut back to the Sumita Ward. Ichijo, Sugita, Sakurai are all finalizing their plans to go try and scout out where the next Grongi location might be when a police courier shows up with a briefcase.
Full of those old aluminum Band-Aid tins.
Certainly what they look like. And he quickly asks, are you part of the ULF squad? Here, these are for you.
It's literally all the confirmation he needed. He handed somebody chemical weapons on a, are you part of the group? Yes. Oh, well, that's good enough for me.
Doesn't ask to see a badge or anything like that. Just a verbal confirmation, because no self-respecting member of the Japanese police force would ever lie about something like this. Law enforcement's as honest as they come. Ichijo is given one of these tins of Band-Aids, and Sugita and Sakurai leave. Just as Ichijo gets into his car, he gets a call from Godai. And, you know, he perks up immediately. You're better? You're okay already? And Godai's like, yeah, I'm right behind you. And pulls up on the motorcycle.
It's Godai. He's a goober. He just does just silly little things.
And he tells Ichijo that he thinks that he needs to use the gold red form to beat Gamego Ray. But that he's worried that the blast is going to be big enough to cause collateral damage.
And in a weird display of authority we didn't know he had, Ichijo's like, go for it.
I'll take care of everything else.
Like, how big is this explosion? This is no longer under your authority, Ichijo. Like, how big is this explosion going to be that you're authorizing him to use?
We don't know yet. We cut back to the hospital. Junichi is being very sullen. And Tsubaki's like, hey, there's gonna be more chances for you to use your art. You look like you're doing better. You're getting treatment. I ran some, once again, unethical because he could not consent to them, tests on you, and I see that you've been improving. That's great.
Yeah, you learned to crack a window. We used aerosols. That's helpful. Brain damage is receding.
You know, keep up with your art. And this sets Junichi off. And he proceeds to go on a rant about how it is all Godai's fault that he didn't get to submit the art piece. Because
the
he...
Lion, the witch, and the audacity of this bitch!
Yeah, the whole thing felt very childish, honest to God. Like, this is a dude who's clearly hit a rough patch in his life, and he has found someone to fixate on and blame it on, despite the fact that that person has never shown him anything but kindness, has honestly saved his ass. Like, yeah. Godai is the fixation of his demons.
And he proceeds to talk about, oh, how it must be so great, get superpowers, get out. Cool nickname, fight monsters. Why hasn't he killed all of them yet?
And then Tsubaki loses like, his fucking cool.
Have you killed someone before? And Junichi, not taking the hints, like, oh, I bet he had that goofy smile on his face and gave the stupid thumbs up. And Tsubaki, nope, this was the line too far. And he grabs the picture and throws it on the bed. And he goes, you might as well destroy this because it's trash just like your trash.
Dude, I fucking love this moment. Like, Tsubaki's just 150% done with his shit. I'm there with him.
Take some accountability for yourself. This is not Godai's fault. You're willing to blame everyone except for yourself.
Producer's note. While the boys are mostly correct, there is one thing that I think is important to go over here. While the way he presents it is disingenuous, it was in fact Godai's fight with Gamego that cost Junichi this contest. Obviously, it wasn't intentional. But when you're constantly fighting and being knocked down through no fault of your own, it's easier to blame someone than accept that you have no control.
And it reaches a point and Junichi throws a punch.
Oh no, she didn't!
Tsubaki just kind of looks at him, he's like, that feel good?
We see a little bit of blood at the corner of his mouth, but we cut to Godai.
Yep.
And he has found Gamego on top of another building. How he found him, who knows, but he did. He jumps up. They begin their fight again, and all of a sudden, bang.
Yeah, no, straight up, he's using the ball and chain. He wraps it around Godai's neck and is like pulling him into a chokehold, choking him out. We hear the bang. And the chain snaps.
And the ball hits the ground and shrinks back. And we look over and Ichijo's across the distance on the fire escape of another building.
With his high-powered rifle.
And he just starts unloading. And
Godai takes the opportunity, puts Turtle Boy in a headlock. So all his hands are in the air and he forces his arms out wide. And Ichijo shoots the rings off his fingers, like the ball and chains that he's transmuting into these artillery shells, shoots all of them off of his hands from a roof away. Oh, it's the same roof. He is on the same roof.
Because
we see him on
the
ground. Yeah. But like, yeah, he shoots all the rings off of his fingers before he collapses, presumably with a broken collarbone.
Yes, particularly on the last shot, we see him go down with the recoil.
Mm-hmm.
And Gamego looks around for a moment because there's nothing left on his hands. And Godai hits him and once again knocks him off the building. And this time he falls through a walkway.
Yep, just crashes straight through a breezeway. In what was pretty campy CGI, but like not in a shitty way. It was like fun campy. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, it did not age well, but it's one of those they didn't linger on it.
Right.
So
it wasn't like front and center for a full 15 seconds. He crashed through the breezeway, cratered on the ground. We're right back into it.
Godai leaps down off the building in dragon form, lands, gets on the bike, switches himself to mighty form, the bike into its Henshin version, and the Goram shows up, merges with the Tri-Chaser, and I thought he was gonna rider break.
Same.
But no, he just plows straight into and proceeds to drive away with Gamego Ray on the front of the Trigoram.
Off to the abandoned warehouse district with you.
Exactly. Ichijo has made some calls and they're like, yep, we've taken care of things. Okay. We cut back to the hospital and this is where Tsubaki's like, did that feel good?
No.
Or did that suck? You feel bad about it?
Yeah.
That's what he's doing. every ULF that Godai fights, he's having to put himself through this.
Yeah, not to mention the toll it's taking on his body the whole time.
Yeah. And he doesn't complain. He's doing it to protect the smiles of everyone else. People like you, you ungrateful little shit.
Yeah, you can hear some vitriol in our voices because, man, Jinichi really did just... It was uncomfortable to watch. It's a grown man displacing his unhappiness onto somebody else who very much doesn't deserve it. And I was so happy Tsubaki called him on his bullshit. Like, yo, grow the fuck up. Deal with your own problems. Everybody has it rough. This isn't easy for Godai either.
No. And then the perfect cherry on top slash twist of the knife, Tsubaki's like, by the way, Godai loved your drawing. He said it felt calming.
Yeah, you actually made a difference, but you couldn't shut the fuck up about your own troubles long enough to notice.
We then cut to the Trigoram showing up at an abandoned factory. This is a location that it seems like they've used a couple times. Could represent a different factory, but man, this looks an awful lot like the one where he fought Zuzane Da.
You know what also looked really familiar is the stack of the perfectly stacked group of boxes and random, you know, warehouse accoutrement that he rams Gamera into.
Yeah, that's par for the course.
Oh, we love it.
Gets off the bike, strikes a pose. The electricity goes up his leg. The driver once again turns gold. And we see more gold trim go across his shoulders, onto his wrist guards, and a shin guard show up on his right leg. He's in Rising Mighty form.
Rising Mighty form has a punching power of 5.7 tons and whopping kicking power of 22 tons.
That's pretty impressive, honestly.
Yeah.
Its max jump height is 29 meters. And it can run 100 meters in 5.2 seconds. It is equipped with the Mighty Anklet on its right leg, empowering its Rising Mighty Kick to a strength of 50 tons.
It's called the Mighty Anklet?
It looks like a shin guard, not an anklet, but okay.
Yeah, I played soccer in grade school. I know what a shin guard looks like.
And Gamego is just like, sure. Try that.
Yeah.
Here, take the hit.
Bro, does the whole the chest out, arms wide, like, you ain't got shit stance.
And Godai runs, foot on fire, jumps, flips, the kick connects. Gamego goes flying, hits the ground, and then goes nuclear. Thermonuclear,
yes.
He did the Monster Mash.
With the explosion, or... Oh, the turtle, yeah.
Gamego is a well-dressed man. And he either has money or connections to dress like that. Not to mention claiming a space in a high-rise to play his game from. There are much worse sugar daddies out there. Mash.
No, I can get behind that.
But the explosion radiates out, and like, we're not joking when it looks nuclear, because it cuts to a rather zoomed out view of the city, and the blast just keeps getting bigger. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, I even made a comment about like Godai not being able to walk away from that cool explosion because he's enveloped by it immediately, as far back as he is. Cannot stress, it's a huge explosion. Like, I don't know how far Ichijo cleared, but I can't help feeling it might not have been enough.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there has to be collateral loss of life here. Mm-hmm. And that's tragic.
It's a cool moment to end on. It's a rough moment to end on. We are into a new category of destructive ability. The blowback from these fights can wipe population centers. And we're not done.
No.
Like, we haven't met our big bad endgame boss that is the master of all of them.
Lord Raiden.
Yep. And we're definitely going to see a final form for Kuga that is definitely going to be stronger than anything we've seen so far. So, damn.
Real quick, looking at my Grongi Dex. There are still three go that we only know the names of, don't know the forms yet. There's also Bada.
Father Jose.
Yes.
Put something's some shadow on that name. He's still around.
Something's going to happen with him. Lord Raiden. And I am given to understand that there are still three more go we have yet to encounter in any way, shape, or form.
Producers note, two in series, one more in a special. Check out our Patreon for that coming soon.
Just got a hole in your Grongid X there, huh?
Yeah. So, things are escalating, and I wonder, am concerned by just how much they're going to escalate.
Hell yeah.
But let's go ahead. We have our responsibility. What are we going to use as our rating? Morning stars?
Morning stars isn't bad.
What about roulette wheels?
I'm for that.
Yeah, we can do that. All right, so, go Gamego Ray.
Gamego's monster form is chunky, providing a unique silhouette compared to the more streamlined Gurungi we're used to. He has some good textures here or there. For once, I'm happy to see the Daipi as it provides what little extra color we get besides dark green. His human form I just don't get. Maybe the head is supposed to represent the shell? The suit is boxy like a box turtle. I don't know, man. I'm grasping at straws here. The clothes at least look good on him. Nothing here is terrible, but none of it is really exciting or innovative. 3 out of 5. His behavior seems based around the Japanese association with turtles and good luck. It gives him a unique flair we haven't seen before. Likewise, he has a pretty laid-back attitude, fitting of a turtle. Kesara Sara combines this attitude with the gambling spirit of letting things play out however they do. While it is something different, it doesn't lead him to being very engaging. 3.5. He certainly has a unique method of killing. It plays into the gambler vibe well. But it's otherwise not very interesting. The roulette adds some flair, but it's still basically just chucking balls and seeing what hits. However, the thematic elements of turtle and artillery or luck mentioned does raise this for me a bit. I'll give it a 4. That's an average of 3.5 roulette wheels from me.
Want to go next?
Sure. So, behavior. Yeah, he's a very laid-back Gurungi, which fits with a gambler aesthetic, the taking up the mantra Ke Sera Sera. Yeah, he seems the type, winning or losing, he'd be, let it ride. We're going to see what happens. It's kind of fascinating where all of the Gurungi up till the go have been somewhat homogenous. These ones have more distinct and unique personalities. Like, he's still focused on the game more in a way than, like, Bimiyu. But I think he's playing the game, the thrill of the gamble. He'd be just as happy to lose because of the time constraint, you know, as he would be to win. And that's fascinating. I'm enjoying seeing how each of these go behave. It's nice to see unique personalities. I do think overall, we didn't see a ton of him. Got a good grasp for what he's like, but I would have liked to have seen more. Behavior's going to be 3.5. Design. I've come to accept that the go, their human forms do not lend themselves to monster form quite in the same way that the meh do, but that it does also make them seem much more human, other than, like, they tend to have weird painted lip colors, I've noticed. But the pinstripe suit and fedora, the real mobster aesthetic, does play into the gambling aspect. That matches up well with that. The turtle form applying to the methodology, as we have all learned today, the associations between turtles and artillery in Japanese culture, that's real fascinating. It does increase the design. He suffers from a lack of color, which, especially after last week and Bimiyu being the most colorful Gurungi we have seen, feels not great. I do enjoy the moving mouth in his monster form. I like the look that the shell and the other armor pieces are chained to him, that they are literally armor. And I agree with what Jed said. He does have a somewhat unique silhouette compared to some of the other Grongi because of just the bulk of him. It's not great, or at least it doesn't blow me away, but it's still above average. I think another 3.5. Methodology, the blend of the gambling, let the wheel decide, but the choice to then divide the city up based off of the roulette wheel. And what we assume is the deck of cards worth of shots in each section, because they still never really explained 54, but he plays poker, and presumably he would have been playing with jokers as well, so that would be 54. Could also be throwing 54 shots. 54 pickup. I think it probably fits more along with the lines of gambling with the jokers as wilds. It's just as complex as the other go, but a much more straightforward compared to last week's. I enjoyed it. I'm going to rate the methodology like a 4. So that brings my total to a 3.666 repeating roulette wheels.
And that brings it to me. This is honestly one of my highest ranked Grongi. Something I picked up on, I think I'm right. I think he's only throwing one projectile, and then it splits into the 54. We only ever see him throw one when he launches, and then we cut to the destruction. Because he was very upset when Ichijo shot the other rings off his other fingers. One hand was already missing a set. So I think he only has a certain number of shots total. And that plays into the gambling thing. Appearance, I'm going to give him a 4.5. We didn't have a lot of color. That's very true. But the aesthetic of the turtle pulled together very well. The idea of the plates being chained to his body as armor. And the gambling aesthetic as the human. For me, it all worked very cohesively. And I was steadily like Googling the other implications of his character. And the more I looked at it, the more everything was drawn together into one cohesive look. All of the different connotations of turtles being expressed here, it all worked for me as one cohesive whole. It didn't have a whole lot of color, but there aren't too many turtles that do. Turtles do tend to have a palette that will blend them into their surroundings pretty well. So the lack of color on this one didn't bother me as much as it does on some of the other ones. The armor plates, the cohesive design, when he transformed, the hat became the armored cowl, so it all did work well together. The gambler aesthetic is human. Yeah, I'm going to give him a 4.5. This one just worked for me. Behavior, I'm going to give him a 4, simply because we didn't have enough to go on. What was there, that just let it ride, laissez-faire indifference to anything that happened. For me, him having a certain number of shots, but not knowing exactly how many kills he would get per shot, and that not bothering him, that played into it for me. So this gambler aesthetic of, fuck it, we're going to see what happens, very much appeals to me. And splitting the city into grid coordinates and doing artillery barrages and being like, oh, how many do I get? 27? Cool. Next. He's never flat by, like, low scores, just whatever happens, happens, and we're going to see if I make my game. I love that. So method, I'm giving a 5 to. So for me, this was a 4.5. So that brings our total score up to a 3.88.
Roulette wheels. Okay.
Roulette wheels, yeah.
It's easy to assume that our hero fighting monsters is always the A-plot in Toku. But this time I think Junichi is the A-plot, because Gamego mostly serves as an obstacle to Junichi's story. I like the moral of Junichi's story once we get there, but until he ends up in the hospital in episode 30 there isn't much to that story. Meanwhile, Gamego's location is found with little trouble, and his game is sussed out soon after. Outside of the fights there isn't tension to this part of the story. There are important things discussed in this episode, but most of it is filler to the point I didn't remember it. I'm going with a 2. The cinematography is actually engaging though. The framing of Jalaiji and Zalazu early in the episode was very striking. The transition into dragon form was rough, but the one into mighty form right after was slick. We get more practical effects, both to the environment and to Gamego himself. The distant shot of Tsubaki and Ichijo backlit is a wonderful way to evoke their loss at what this all means. It alone is enough to get this a 4. The fights were nice. Destroying scenery always ups tension in a fight. And the things like Karuga kicking one of the balls out of the air, flipping over Gamego's shell, and Gamego just straight rejecting Rising Calamity Titan are just hype as fuck to me. It's not as good as last week's, but it's good enough to get a 4. That's 3.3 repeating roulette wheels for my overall score.
Alright, plot. I do think I agree with you, Jed, that Jinichi is the A-plot, and that is to the detriment of these two episodes. I know I said that I would re-examine the character if he showed up again because I just was not fond of him. This has done nothing to change my view of him.
This didn't help.
I'm very glad to hear that he is receiving treatment for whatever this medical illness is, and that is great. I hope that he is able to find peace. I'm glad that he started his artwork up again. But, the entitled rant about blaming Kuga, who is, you know, putting his own life on the line to save everyone and to say he's not doing enough, it's his fault. Like, I get being in a dark place and lashing out at the world. It's realistic. But I don't want to watch that. It was so cathartic to have Tsubaki go off on him. But it's just not what I wanted overall for the plot. I think the B-plot of Gamego and the concerns over what is happening to Yusuke, while yes, it is a thing that we are continuously seeing every few episodes, seeing the nuclear explosion at the end of episode 30, I feel it is warranted that we keep coming back to this. It's salvaged by its B-plot, but I think I'm going to have to go with a 2.5. Cinematography was a lot better than storyline. Some great shots, yes. The Tsubaki and Ichijo long shot in the backlit waiting room by the vending machine, great. The use of CG, sure, it hasn't aged well, but they didn't hang on it as much as they could have. And the use of practical effects, destruction of the environment during combat, having the wound in Gamego showing a shocking amount of blood on the Rising Titan sword. Every time the Go-Ram shows up since it's practical. All of that was great. I think cinematography is a 4. Combat, I enjoyed immensely. The fact that we got 3 different forms within the first fight against Gamego, great. I would love to see Kuga do more mid-fight switches like that. Knowing that we have a time constraint on rising forms adds to the tension, and to that extent makes it a bit more special when they show up. To see Rising Calamity Titan get shrugged off, that really impressed me. The second fight, I will say, loses some points for Gamego being like, yeah, take your shot, and just getting atomized. But I think, yeah, I think a 4 as well. That brings my overall score to a 3.5 roulette wheels.
So this is an odd turn of events, because generally I feel like I'm the harsher critic, but in these two particular episodes, I feel like I was a little more generous. I'll start with the plot. Plot, I gave it a 3.5, because even though we had the sidebar of Jinichi being a woe-is-me little bitch, I didn't care. And you're absolutely correct. It felt great to have Tsubaki call him on his bullshit and not let him get away with putting that at Godai's feet. And I feel like that was an important point for them to make in the series, of to lay the fault for all of this at the only person who's actually able to help is not only inappropriate, but disrespectful to him as a character. And I love that. And I feel like we needed the lead up to that. Like, yeah, this guy's fallen on hard times. He's doing his damnedest to recover. And shit just keeps getting worse. He's down and he keeps getting kicked. But that doesn't mean you get to just put the blame on somebody else. Stop it. I liked that. But the explosion at the end and the connotations of that, because that's just a kick. Like, we're not even at Frieza with no ears yet. Going through the different Go and them discussing their refocusing of Kuga is like, okay, this might be something we actually have to deal with. Very important. So I do feel like we made some important plot progress. We got new lists of upgraded munitions for our police officers. So hopefully Ichijo will be able to be a little more relevant this fight. That was awesome. So yeah, plot 3.5. Cinematography 4.5. Because we had everything I needed on my checkbox to rank this episode well on this. We did have some campy special effects. We pointed them out. We laughed at them. But they weren't so glaringly obvious that they detracted from the scenes they were in. It's like we talked about when Gamera fell through the breezeway. Just crunch, crunch, done, impact. Even that primitive CGI was used in a way that contributed to the episode in a meaningful way. We got a lot of good practical effects. The wrecking ball in our fights. We got tons of really, really good stuff here. The shots with our characters were compelling. Even the punch that was thrown at Tsubaki felt real. And that would have been an easy one to just phone in. This felt filmed like a modern show. Did itself justice, and that's a 4.5 for me. Fights, 4.8. We had everything again on my checkbox to make these good fights. We had multiple form changes. We had Godai learning to use some forms for traversal, some for combat, and to switch as he needed to on the fly. That's something we haven't seen much of yet. We did get several long and protracted fight scenes, both in terms of close combat and environmental damage, and we had practical effects come in. We saw their clever way of adding a crater to a municipal setting that they could not destroy, but all of it worked very well together. We felt the danger. We actually got to see blood effects, which was not something I expected to see too much of. The turtle really was a strong enough competitor to put Kuga through his paces, and I don't think Godai would have made it through that last fight without Ichijo's support. And that was awesome to see. We got the big explosion at the end. We got to see a new, honestly, probably one of the most impressive rider kicks in the series so far as our finisher, and a cataclysmic explosion at the end. It's a 4.8 because I'm sure there will be a 5 somewhere.
Just give it a 5, man.
You're taking advantage of my being hamstrung by technical difficulties.
Guilty.
Giving this one a 5 would not take away from you giving another fight a 5 in the future. It's not a you only get one.
Fine, it's a 5 for me. Like, it straight up is. This was a great fight. I enjoyed every minute of what happened. There was enough combat for us to rank, which hasn't always been true. It was a challenge for Godai. He lost the first one in a very real, almost punishing way. Even when Gamera at the very end just holds his arms wide and lets Godai take his shot, that played into his character. Either I'm going to win or I'm going to lose right freaking here. Even the way the fights were conducted played into the characters themselves. And it worked for me. So that's a 5. And that gives me a 4.33 on this episode. That gives these episodes a 3.722, then 111 repeating. Roulette wheels.
Just go with the 3.72, I guess.
Fine. 3.72 roulette wheels. I gotta say, these were some of my favorite episodes. These felt good.
Yeah, since the Go have shown up, things have just been
consistently
better.
Yeah.
Starting with Galma, everything moving forward since then has just been consistently good.
Mm-hmm.
Join us next week when we will be watching episodes 31 and 32, Retaliation, and Obstacle.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack. For $5 a month, you get access to monthly bonus episodes, like our Suffering at Saban's Masked Rider.
How dare you make me change my opinions?
Oh, boo-hoo, we made you admit you liked a thing as much as you do.
Rude. It's just rude.